This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard given on the 17th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is Tolerance of Unknowingness. This lecture is 62 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
All right, let's sail into some material here. It's about time we covered. There's a lot of data, which is apparently stray data, which an auditor needs. The best way to cover this is to cover the use of the material which we have talked about in this Fourth London unit in practical auditing. You should be able to see your preclear as a series of phenomena which triggers or doesn't trigger. He is in this condition at the beginning of auditing. He has some feeling that he himself is energy. He has been educated by every school of thinkingness extant in the Western world, except, of course, for those very tiny outposts from the East, such as the Buddhist Church and so forth, into believing he is mass. And at best, mass. And just for variation, mass. And he feels that if he came up tone scale, he would become energy. And that is the education by which Western civilization is attempting to carry forward the abilities of man. Carry them forward to an ash can and dump them in. Now, this character who's sitting there in front of you, if he's had any kind of education, believes that his brain thinks. That he's thinking this is done by his brain. Therefore, when you start to process him, you will discover inevitably that he's waiting for something else to do the process for him. And let me assure you that the day a brain thought a thought has never dawned and never will dawn, and that all this mass of neurons and spurons and burrows or whatever else they got in there is not even a relay system by which the body is controlled, but is an electronic shock pad, which was developed by generated currents of shock. And its evolution is very easy to trace. A cell emits an electrical impulse on being struck. A thetan is apt to put out a beam if something starts to hit him. And when you strike a number of cells in a small area, the combined electrical shock is passed on to cells beyond the area of impact. And this current is injurious to the cells in the vicinity of the injured cells. And being injurious, there has then come about a conduit system to pass off and absorb this impulse and these impulses. And these things are called neurons, the gaps which are regulated to monitor the shock impulse and are monitored solely and entirely by the shock impulse. You understand, there's no thinkingness with this, are called the synapses. Now, any way you want to look at this and or classify it or call it right or wrong, is all right with me, because it's just about as unimportant as we could get. Now, if I stood here and talked about trucks and the wiring and distributor system of trucks, I would be talking about a far more vital function than the brain in relationship to thought. Because at least the distributor system of a truck aids and abets the motive power of the truck. Now, this is a very important thing to an auditor, since in this society he is continually presented by cases that sit there and figure every auditing command to such a degree that they just wait. The stable datum on which they're operating is there's something else in their heads that's getting audited. It's just as silly as this. And that something is probably a brain. They're educated to believe this. Well, listen, the brain not only does not know anything, the postulate in the center of the brain is not knowing anything about not knowing. So the more he fools around with this thing called a brain, and the more he fools around with the idea that the brain is thinking, the tighter he's going to get riveted into his skull. And the more you audit him on this subject, and the more you pander to this idiocy that thinking and monitoring the system and the automatic machinery of the body is all included in the neurons and the rest of it, the more you give ground to this or pamper him in this regard, the more fixated he's going to get and the more stupid he's going to get. You see that? I mean, there's a real nasty operation going on in Western civilization. Now, that's the first group of phenomena which we are facing, and I'll go over the important parts of it again. The preclear is normally not being audited. He is auditing something else while you're auditing him. And you then, on a via, are auditing some kind of an electronic sponge which has an unlimited tear-apartness. There's an unlimited amount of sponge electrical energy to rip to pieces there. There is no end to that. If you started to unmock the brain by adding in postulates and that sort of thing, it is highly doubtful in the average preclear if you would be able to do this in 25 or 30 years at the rate of 2 or 3 hours of auditing a day. That's the average preclear. Somebody else might be able to come along and say, brain, no brain. But he'd have to be in pretty doggone good condition. Now, it's very important. Then, on the second series of data, I mean, just right in part of that same thing, it's very important to realize that we have found the rock bottomness of postulates. Now, you know guys that go around And they're trying to look a little deeper to find a little bit more all the time, you know. There's always something under the something. Well, of course, we could suppose that there was an infinity of this and that there were an infinity of bottoms, that every time we'd stand on one low level, we would always find another low level under that. And every time we were standing on that low level, having attained that, we would then get to another low level. And it's a thought that this activity would then be an infinite series, and it is not an infinite series. You can examine this if you wish, but as far as life is concerned, the infinite series is not infinite. It ends abruptly and finally with this postulate, which is to be found in the middle of black masses, indestructible masses of one kind or another. And these things contain this postulate. I don't know that I don't know, or that there's anything to know. And that's the postulate in the middle of these masses. That's bottom. I very seldom make a forthright statement. Just all out, you know. Wham! That's it. Take it or not, as you will, but that's it. I very seldom make a forthright statement. But I've seen these black masses tear apart, which were indestructible on anything else. See, I've seen these things come apart, and I know what I'm talking about. You know, there are black energy masses kicking around in a pre-clears bank, which have heretofore been all but indestructible. And the only way he could destroy them at all or anything was simply, you know, kind of put them over to the right or left or hide them in his left-hand pocket. Or we simply brought him up to a point where he'd tolerate the stuff and so didn't pay much attention to it. But as far as actually destroying one of those screens is concerned, even communication processing has fallen short. You know why? Because if something doesn't know that it doesn't know, or that there is anything to know at all, that's a real blanket thing, you know, it also knows it's impossible to communicate. The only thing that really you could get to the rock bottom on, and this becomes very easy, the only thing you could really get to rock bottom on, the thing would just be to throw this postulate into the middle of the mask. Now, one of the ways you could do this, and the way it was tested, was to throw up two of these black masses, go locate two of them, you know, and put them side by side and keep pouring the postulate into the two of them as they stood there, a match terminal, which also is very shaking to any of these things. See, they didn't go to pieces because they couldn't communicate with each other before. And you just keep throwing the postulate into the centers of them. You're remote from them, you see. You throw the postulate into the centers of them, and the postulate is, I don't know that I don't know, or there's anything to know. And they go, ugh. Which is real cheerful. They come upscale and go into communication. There are many higher levels of this, which are in... unthinkably low. There's I don't have anything to know just now, you know, that's a higher level. Knowing this is possible, but I don't see how. All kinds of little stupidities, gradients. But when you get down to the exact center of masses which don't easily surrender, why, we find out that it doesn't know that it doesn't know, or that there's anything to know. And this is a bleh. Now, this operates as the world's finest little handy jim-dandy vacuum. How does it operate as a vacuum? There's a play running down here called Waiting for Godot. This masterpiece of idiocy may or may not have been written by anybody who knew anything about Scientology. He might have just been nuts. But he packed into this thing just enough significance in a tremendous amount of unknownness to make a pseudo-intellectual audience come back and send their friends and come back and come back and come back. What are they doing? They're sitting there looking at the unknownness of the whole thing. In the first place, it's deadly. It's sitting on the time track. It is not moving on it. In the second place, they don't know what they're waiting for or why they are waiting. And in the third place, they are waiting for something that the audience never finds out what they're waiting for or why. And then the acceptance level of the audience is amply and adequately achieved by the complete dishabille of the characters. There's one very bright point in it, which is quite interesting, and that is the fact that a fellow walks on stage who is very well dressed with a man on a rope who is carrying things for him. In other words, a human carrier, a slave, that he treats as a beast of burden. And this is quite a shock, probably, to the audience here and there. Gives them something to talk about, but it's one little drop of something in this sea of unknownness, and only serves to punctuate that the rest of it is unknown. There's one other good spot in it. They say, well, let's pass the time away, let's insult each other, and they say hog and pig and so forth, and then one of them, as they're standing, these two bums across the stage from each other, one of them says to the other one, critic, as an insult, and the bum who has had critic said to him, of course, folds up at that instant, gets deathly ill. No other insult has done anything to him except this one. Which I thought was very, very sharp. And note at the same time the critic's are now seeing that a theatrical revolution is going to take place because of this thing. See, they have to defend it one way or the other. But here's just a couple of drops of something or other in a sea of unknownness. And, of course, an audience will go and go and go, and more audiences will go and go and go. Why? This is the crudest thing you ever saw in your life. They have simply put up a thorough unknownness, and the audience is coming back to it. Swish, see? That's all. You would go out here in the street and have a fancy gimmick-a-wob, and stand there and look at this gimmick-a-wob. And just stand there and look at it. You'll collect a crowd. See, there isn't anything there. It's just a somethingness, which is really a nothingness, but nobody knows about anyhow, and people come around and look at it. The reason they're trying to do this, and the reason they go to see that play, is the reason why people have a scarcity of problems. All right, well, we'll get on to that in a moment. Now, let's take a look at that unknownness. Unknownness, in terms of knowingness, could be characterized as don't know, that I don't know, or if there's anything to know, and that would be the rock-bottom unknownness where you'd still have something. Isn't that right? There is still something there, but it doesn't know that there's anything to know. Now, that's real low stuff. Good. And one of these characters starts ripping his brain apart, and this is the kind of a mass he gets. This is the mass he restimulates. A mass which doesn't know that it doesn't know or that there's anything to know. And this, ladies and gentlemen, is the human brain. Because when you start to take it apart, mass by mass, neuron by neuron, the only way it comes apart effectively and adequately is to keep throwing this postulate into those masses, that it doesn't know anything to know and that there is nothing to know. And this, for God's sakes, has been the seat of reason. On an agreement basis, you see. A fellow says, if anything happens to my brain, I therefore will not be able to coordinate the body. And he's got it all on nice automatic, see. Well, he's got his agreements going down the line like this as a living being. They have measured various injuries to the mind, the brain, and so forth, and said that it shut off this and it shut off that, and so on. You have a basis of agreement there. The funny part of it is you can turn these things on as fast as they go out of agreement without doing anything more to the brain. This is very odd. Very odd, I assure you. We have somebody who's had a stroke, and it's a blood clot. And he's in terrible condition and so forth because the nerves in the brain and some of the arteries in the brain and so forth are now all in a mess, you know. And he'll sit there and be all in a mess. Unless you run a third level process on him or fix him up so he can run a third level process. At that time you change all this all the way around without patching up any neurons. And without unsnapping any synapses. Now, a thetan will come along and he will look at a mass which has this postulate inside of it. And he will say, what the hell is in there? What's in there? And because he's looking at it, he tends to go into duplication with it. Communicating with something brings upon one some responsibility for duplicating it. All right, let's just stand around and stare at a mass which doesn't know that it doesn't know or that there's anything to know and stay bright. That's fantastic. How the devil could these two things get locked up? How could man postulate to the degree that he has postulated that knowingness is in the middle of the brain? Unless, of course, he wanted to stick everybody in his skull. Now, man from time to time has changed his mind about all this. He's changed his mind about all this. One time, during Greek days, man was sure that everybody thought with his stomach. And the Greeks thought just as well or better than modern man. So actually, where this thinkingness is located is not very important. I suppose some race will arise sooner or later that is sure you think with your ring finger. Everybody will be going around preserving their ring finger so that it will do all its thinking. Or somebody could carry around a small black box and say, this is my thinker, and let it do all of his thinking for him. Or he could come around with a radar hat, you know, and all he could say, all of my thinking is being done from central headquarters. And very often in a decadent electronic society, this is exactly what occurs. There's a thought tower in the town, and it does all the thinking for the whole town. If you think a thought antipathetic to the better good of the people of the town, a criminal thought or something like this, why, your thinkingness is all being done over there, and it's merely being relayed to you, so you're supposed to walk over and turn yourself in and say, well, that's the way it is, and I thought this horrible thought, and of course they throw you in a box and turn on the Jews. Civilizations have constructed themselves entirely on where is the thinking done. Well, now this civilization has really figured out a honey. The stomach doesn't have as many of these black sheets in it as the head has. And if you start this thing that doesn't know that there's nothing to know, and you transfer all thinkingness to this, it is no sillier, really, than transferring all thinkingness to a thought tower in town. Oh, that is doing all of my thinking for me. Now, soldiers transfer their thinkingness to their sergeants and officers. And the sergeants and officers transfer their thinkingness. I'll just give you a graphic illustration of how ridiculous this can get. They transfer their thinkingness to generals. Now, have you got a suitable analogy? Now, what keeps the Thetan looking at this? Well, I tell you. He's looking at it because it's unknown. And you make a vacuum with an unknownness so as to excite curiosity. And then it goes on down the DEI scale. Curiosity, desire, enforce, inhibit. Curiosity, desire, enforce, inhibit. See, going on down tone scale? And they go from top to bottom of scale. Because here you've got a rock bottom thing, which is death. If a Thetan were to get into that condition, he'd be dead. And he's simply led down there by something is unknown, so he looks at it. Now we could carry all the way downscale and figure out the most unknown thing that is, and the most unknown thing that is, just theoretically you'd arrive at, would be a don't know that I don't know and they don't know, and I don't know that there is anything to know. And that, of course, would be bottom of the barrel. And it is. Masses, black masses, tear up when this thrush was thrown into them. All right, now let's take a look at this thing called, actually it's just a hypnotic fixation by that time. Thetan starts looking at it, and then he begins to think that he doesn't know anything about knowing either, and he thinks what he gets out of a body, why, in view of the fact that that brain did all of his thinking for him, it certainly must have been doing something. Anything laid out this fancy must have had some purpose. And it must have been doing, and he will back off of the body and he will rationalize then, but he will say to himself, well, it was aware for me. He's just transferred his thinkingness, and so when he flips from life to life, he lays aside his personality. And he has other rationale, other reasons why he's doing this, but none of these reasons hold up. So yeah, there is no real reason why you shouldn't be able to remember and utilize any skill you have picked up anywhere. You're not so delicate that you can't face the fact that your wife and kids kicked the bucket and that the war wiped out the town. You know, you're not delicate-minded to this degree. You could live through this. So that happened in the last life. Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't remember. Except for this. Everybody doesn't know about your past. And we have every person not knowing about any other person's past. And so we compound this not knowingness. If you will think for a moment of your immediate family when you were a child, and think of how they, here goes everybody, anything. And think how this family, I don't want you to go into, that's why I said that. That your family walked around and stood around and didn't know you had ever been anything. And they didn't know you had ever done anything and didn't know where you came from or what you did, but supposed something quite erroneous, that you were just a little baby that was growing up and had to be taught everything. Well, they're not knowing this, that this took place, would wipe it out in your head, too. See, here's this amount of unknownness, you see. So you look at their unknowingness on this subject, and you say, huh? Get the idea? All right. Now, if you look at somebody's, if you look at somebody's brain, and it is not just as stupid as the family, it is rock bottom stupid. See, there is nothing more stupid than this. And if you spend all of your time looking at this thing, ladies and gentlemen, I assure you, you're going to wind up a citizen. You'll elect Mr. Skullbum to the highest office in the land, and you'll not complain when somebody walks along and says to you that now all money must be made out of iron. And a pound literally means a pound. And a pound must be a pound of iron. And therefore, all our money is now going to be pounds of iron. And that's the way it is. And you'd say, well, there must be some reason. Of course, if you want to have a good game, I suppose, just get stupid. This is a popular fallacy. They say a good football player is all muscle and no brain, you know. And it's not true at all. As a matter of fact, I've known some football players who were all muscle, but they weren't good football players. Some of the real sharpies who were real fast on their feet and real sudden and so on were quite bright boys if you started talking to them. And the boys who looked awfully massive but who really had made the aggregate errors of the season and who had slowed down the whole works, but they looked impressive. You know, they had that much mass. They were stupid, too. But I've seen guys that looked impressive and had mass that were bright as new shillings. Now, what about this? What about this? Why would anybody want this much unknownness? Well, I tell you, this is why I don't know and problems seem to be craved by the individual. Now, we've had lectures on the data of comparable magnitude, right? And he's got so damn much of this on the track that he keeps telling himself, if I can just get myself into a problem similar to some of those problems back down the line, I'll at least get a match terminaling or something of the sort, and the things will go, you know? And if I could get myself into exactly the same problem in this moment that I got into 5 years ago, the five-year-ago problem will, of course, run out. Here's this consistent effort to run something out. Very fascinating, because this is the mechanism of dramatization. An individual has this problem on the backtrack. Now, to get rid of that problem in that situation, he gets into a similar situation. In order to get rid of that situation, he'll have two terminals. And these two terminals then, in some way or another, could communicate with each other, and he'd blow it. Well, maybe this worked once. Maybe it worked for millions or trillions of years for a Thetan. But it hasn't worked now for millions or trillions of years. This could have been an automatic mechanism that has been lost on the time track. But it still leaves one with the obsession, because it's on the back track too, that he'd better have an awful lot of problems in order to get his past problems run out. The way to clear yourself then is to get in trouble. See how that would be? Well, a fellow follows the dictates of energy, and the dictates of energy tell him to get in trouble because he collected his most energy when he was in trouble. So therefore, he gets in trouble. And there could be just a mechanical response on it, which it is in the stupidity level. But in the thinkingness level, a fellow says, if I just get into enough trouble, I'll get enough experience, so then I'll be able to take care of myself. Oh, no. You mean if I get into trouble, then I won't get into trouble because I'll keep on getting into trouble. See that this doesn't equate. But it makes such a horrible unknownness that it itself, as a factor, gets an individual bird-dogged on it. But get this mechanism. If I get into trouble in present time, similar to the trouble I got into 5 years ago, then the trouble I got into 5 years ago will no longer worry or trouble me because I'm in trouble here in present time. We, of course, exceeded logic. One of these darn fool Q&A mechanisms. Follow me? So we get an apparent thirst for problems, which we cure evidently by mocking them up and getting someone's scarcity of problems remedied. Because he can mock these things up, and then he starts mocking them up, and he says, look, they don't have to happen to me in actuality. I can dream up problems which are of comparable magnitude in the backtrack. Now, we had somebody right here the other day that was in bed after some auditing and so on, and they just started going back down the track and picking up and kind of as-ising an awful lot of past problems on the whole track. Curious, but not really curious. This person had decided to pick them up where they were and see if they couldn't be as-ised one way or the other. Well, in keeping with that, then you get this manifestation. As soon as we give the guy enough problems, we ask him to dream up problems, to imagine some one after the other, and he imagines all these problems. And having imagined all these problems, he all of a sudden says, you know, I'm just making up problems. I'm just making up problems, so I'll get solutions to them, and it's kind of a game. And he'll flash on us, and he'll say, that is what I'm doing. He'll cognite. And for a moment, or 10 minutes, or a day, or 2 days, we'll be clear of problems and solutions. Clear as a bell. He's clear of everything but this one. This little gimmick is still standing there. He still has problems on the back track that need running out. And when one of these things stirs uneasily, he says, The automatic response to this is to get in trouble or have a problem quick. See that? And this clear feeling goes out, just like that. Restimulation. In other words, we don't have the track cleared, as we know very well in Dianetics. Now, all you have to clear the track of, oddly enough, the only thing of which you have to clear the track, actually, is a person's intolerance for stupidity. And as soon as you get the track cleared on this, it doesn't go into restimulation anymore. He doesn't resist it. Now, how would you increase somebody's tolerance for stupidity? Well, that's real easy. You could give them a straight wire question on level 3. But that would be crude. So we give him an invent-type question. We say, tell me a kind of not-knownness or don't-know that you wouldn't mind confronting. Give me some unknownness you wouldn't mind observing. Any such command, worded so it communicated with the pre-clear, you see, would start to increase his tolerance for not-knownness. And as soon as his tolerance for not-knownness, and this today is the center trick of Scientology. You get this? This is the middle trick of the middle. As soon as you have remedied his intolerance for stupidity, he no longer gets snapped in automatically by every mass that has stupidity as its center postulate. And therefore, the sideshows don't work anymore on him. Got that? the sign saying, Two-Headed Roy. One is the face of a boy, one is the face of a cat. How did he get that way? Has to be seen to be believed. Well, that's sort of mild, isn't it? How about this one? The unknown jungles of Yup Yup have delivered up this unquestionably unknown object, which, in its unknown patterns of behavior, scare people half to death. The sideshows. Now, one of these sideshows is the human brain. You understand? I'm not saying human mind. The human brain. I set out 25 years ago, man and boy, as they say in the Middle West of the United States, to find out what the devil this brain was all about. Well, we've certainly finished an end of cycle there with this morning's lecture. I'll tell you what it's all about. I know all about it. And if you look it over, you'll know all about it, too. And the very funny part of it is we're in a position so that we can know all about it now. Because we know that we can know about not knowingness. And that is about the darndest thing that ever happened. And that's what it's all about. Now, how many ways can you dream up a stupidity? That's the human mind. I knew by a little bit of investigation and examination, I knew very well in Wichita in 1951, sitting around shooting the breeze with the guys, I all of a sudden cognited on something. I knew that you could not be human and be right. It was just impossible. There was no slightest possibility of being human and be right. You know, the old scale of right and wrong, there's an old book, Notes and Lectures, 1950. Well, this showed a scale where infinite rightness would be infinite survival and infinite wrongness would be infinite non-survival. And this scale goes out in gradients toward one direction or the other direction. And a human being is so far from being right that he's over on the negative side. You know, this is real wild. I figured this out, and it was an appalling fact. And we discussed it, we talked about it, and the kids around, they discussed this in a mingled set of emotions running between horror and glee. You could not be right and be human. If you were human, or if you associated with humans, you would have to be wrong. You go on being right in association with humans, and you break all possible communication with them, just like that. You just run right straight out of communication. You become incomprehensible. Now, just the other day, one of the leading science fiction magazines in the States, which at one time carried some of the early articles on Dianetics, burst forth in print after having gone along with the field, a lot of which didn't like Dianetics. Call it an invasion of privacy. It knew too much about them, you know. They felt like somebody was looking over their shoulder. And this had gone along with this feeling and actually occasionally had been bitterly hostile. This magazine, in its last issue, has swung back onto this side of it. Talks about me, doesn't mention me by name. It merely describes how long and where and every single vital statistic, you see. And says that, well, now he 98% right in his predictions, leaving about 2% doubtful on the subject of the mind. And this 2% doubtful is in doubt as to its doubtfulness, because it usually in the next few months will also materialize as being factual. And the trouble with this man Bitterness, bitterness, bitterness. The trouble with this man, he is so invariably and so incredibly right. So now you see what's wrong with me. But actually, here is a human being getting upset about somebody's rightness. It's not in a joking fashion either. I mean, it's really upset. Now, here we have a demonstration of this. I evidently broke terminals with this individual because of this. And he is just now, the editor of that magazine, admitting how come it came about. He just couldn't stand this amount of rightness. Couldn't take it. It was upsetting to him. And he's now said so in print. Well, he's obviously trying awful hard to be human. And we look over this, and I leave it to you just as a philosophic exercise. There's no reason to elaborate upon it. We look over this fact that you really can't be right and be human, that in order to keep on being human, you have to keep on being wrong. Not just lightly. I mean, you have to keep on being wrong in all directions. Wonderful. The agreements on wrong and so on. I just leave that to you as a philosophic exercise. You can just amuse yourselves with that while you're having a cup of tea, because it's really a ball. We find in the midst of all this that in order to be good and wrong, we've set up that thing which has as its center structural postulate, I don't know that I don't know, or that there's anything to know. The human brain has the thing which is doing all of its thinking for us. Now we look this over, and we find out that nobody possibly could have won in the field of the mind if all the time he was assigning thinkingness to a thing that was so far from being a machine, it was directly inoperative as a machine. I know this sounds incredible. How can the body function? I don't know how the body can function. If the body is depended upon to function as a machine, I have no idea. Of course, it's kind of cute, and its structural lines and designs, the wrists bend and the arms sing, the face expressing, it's real cute. But if we think it's handled by a system of neurons which pull and inflate a system of muscles, we are just asking some medical student and some psychologist to interiorize, but good. We're telling him a falsity. It gets that way and evidently operates because the fellow is able to consider that it does. And he considers that his face does this and this. And if he simply considers his face does this and this, he's in beautiful condition. See? But if he figures his face does so and so and so and so, because of a bunch of machinery which is making his face do so and so and so and so, he's nuts. Right away, he can't make his face do so and so. See? So that we come around and we ask an actor. We say to this actor who is playing the role of Julius Caesar and so forth, and we ask him, we say, just how do you handle yourself during that scene? And he goes out there next time like this. It's just fatal to ask any actor how he does it. Now, knowing a few tricks about thinkingness, people ask me occasionally, how do I give all these lectures and think these things up and so forth? And of course, this is a joke. This is just a joke. It's nothing more than that. Because I know how I'm doing it. I'm doing it. You get the idea? It's very simple. But because people demand more explanation, this poor actor will stand there and consent to be wronger and wronger, you see. I do it because I studied with Stanislavski. My teacher, my tutor on the subject, taught me how to walk dominantly. And you walk dominantly, you see, by arranging the position of the feet and legs in... This is wonderful. The more he explains, the less he's going to act, because there are no vias. And the more he explains how he does it or learns how to do it, the more vias he gets on the line which aren't so. So his ability to act will deteriorate, because now there is something to deteriorate. Up to that time, there's nothing to deteriorate. You understand that? But to keep on being human, to be a good fellow, and to stay in social report with his fellow man, he says, well, I act because I went to school, and I studied this way, and I studied that way, and he'll take some young actor who's just doing fine, and he'll start teaching him how to act, too, as revenge, usually, because the young fellow's been asking him how he did it, you know? And the two of them will get together, and the next thing you know, the audience is asleep. Something has happened here. What they've done is introduce vias on the line. And being human, they, of course, were getting more and more wrong. A totality of being human would be an infinity of wrongness. Just because of this, they agree with one another on vias. And the more vias you agree upon and the more excursions you take in order to arrive at a direct effect, well, the more can be interfered with. You see that? So that theoretically, you actually don't even need a body in order to do anything the body can do. And the best way to go about this is to try to sort your way past any and all vias of making sounds in space and any and all vias of making yourself move in any fashion. You got it. But the effort of a thetan to talk in empty air is quite interesting. Because he accepts at that moment all the human agreements that the eardrums have to be vibrated by air vibrations, and this has to go up a certain set of neurons, and the thetan picks it up off the left-hand bank or something. See? And a thetan starts to talk in empty air. It's necessary then to set air molecules in vibration. And this is a trick. You start setting air molecules in vibration just exactly the way they're supposed to be set in vibration, so they'll register according to human agreement, and the next thing you know, you're standing there, not invisible at all. You're a solid mass trying to make this air vibrate, you see? Now, a thetan, however, trying to talk to a human being, finds this very unsatisfactory. He just makes a consideration, and the other person picks it up. It's very unpositive. Do you know the human being never acknowledges it? Human being is below that level of communication. And you walk up to somebody and you throw out the consideration, just as a straight communication. You say, hello, Joe. He goes on reading his newspaper. Now you take some little kid or a bright dog, something that's superhuman, and you say to this, you say to this bright kid or a bright dog, you say, hiya, Billy. He'll say, hiya. The dog will say, yeah. See, it's interesting. Why doesn't Joe do it? He's too numb, that's why. Now, if you walk up to him and look at him very fixedly and you say, how are you, Joe? To really get Joe to answer you, you very often have to move your face around to get your face and face his. And he finally wonders, what's this fellow doing, you know? And he finally looks at you and he says, hello. Up to that time, he's usually said, how are you? I'm talking just about any guy you'd meet out in society. You just walk up to him and say, hello. And he'll kind of look at you and look down at whatever he's doing again, you know? They're kind of out of communication. Well, now, if you can't do it easily, presenting him with agreed upon mass called a body, with the proper vibrations and everything else, think how much less aware he is to just a consideration across. Now, I'm very sure this can be done. See, it's a field of study in which I have engaged for some time, but just haven't amassed any actual know-hows on the thing, probably because there aren't any. And what I'm evidently trying to do is to delete enough know-hows off the line so as to get a communication line. You see how that could be? But one could still have a bunch of know-how that he was absolutely sure existed that he wasn't even looking at, which would restrain him from accomplishing his ends. Follow me? All right. Now, let's look at this thing about being right and being human. We look at all of these activities of rightness and wrongness, and we discover in these activities a consistent desire to displace the center of thought to something else. A thetan never likes to take the responsibility, it seems, for thinking the thought he just thunk. And that is why we say the stomach thinks, the brain thinks, the central tower in the town thinks. Joe thought of this, I didn't. Why does he do this? We have to look over ownership processing. A postulate cannot as is, unless you get the proper owner. Now, a lot of fellows are going around saying, I'm trying to undo my considerations. And they just don't undo. And processing doesn't work. Did you ever consider they were somebody else's considerations? Well, no. Now, that's the interesting part of it. The interesting part of it is that you can undo your own considerations with such ease that you don't have a game unless they're somebody else's. All you have to do is say, these are my thoughts, and whew, they will go. In view of the fact that time itself is a consideration, you have to handle it with kid gloves. So we say God thought of time. Somebody else thought of time. Human beings never agreed on this, and we've removed it entirely out of the sphere of where time came from. It's running on automatic now. Somebody else owns it. But it is persisting, and we do have this thing called persistence. And this thing called persistence is a very interesting mechanism. Now, if we take responsibility for the thoughts we actually think, and also realize that other people thought the thoughts they thought, we get an unmocking of any situation. But we have to realize who thought the thought. Therefore, the only thoughts on which you are operating, it's horrible. I hate to do this to you. The only thoughts on which you are operating are thoughts you have thought and said somebody else thunk, or thoughts somebody else thought and you said were your thoughts. Now, somebody else thought series A to G, and they're all alive, and you said you thought them, which makes them persist, you see. So any thought that you are holding on to is absolutely yours, must have been thought by somebody else. And any thought which you are absolutely certain is somebody else's, and which is persisting, is yours. To get a persistence, as we look at ownership processing in general, and its tests, and these tests are very, very interesting, they're very positive. If you start sorting them out on an E-meter, or some such thing, you just see N-grams and all kinds of things going poof, poof, poof. But we don't particularly want all those to go poof, 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 you see, so it's not a highly popular, up-to-date process. It's a good process, but it's not the best process that we could possibly have, you see. It hurts people's havingness a bit after a period of time. It also hurts the persistence of some things they want to persist. But you get the idea now that an individual whose thoughts worry him says, why do I think all these things? Couldn't possibly have thought these things, you see. Why do they think all these things? Why are these horrible things being thought by these people, and yet these things persist? It must be then, to some degree, that he thought of him himself. So we have to have a crossover to get a misownership on a set of thoughts or opinions in order to get a persistence of these thoughts and opinions. One of the reasons why it's impossible, then, to get a continued persistence of mass and be right. You have to be wrong to get a persistence of mass on an automatic basis. Now, there's another way to get a persistence of mass. You mock it up, you get somebody to agree to it, and then both of you agree that it's going to keep on going. You don't have to get it wrong at all. Unfortunately, the two of you are together next Tuesday, and you've mocked up this table, and you both look at it. no table. You get mad and you say, well, you can't have any of the furniture in the house. I just took away my agreement on it. You can still see it, but I don't. No more furniture as far as other human beings concerned. I mean, this would be, it would be then with this idiotic simplicity that anybody could come along and unmock the works. So we get much more involved. We get these considerations which add up to misownership. And we decide to be wrong and then assign all of our thoughts to some other thinkingness. And that makes them untraceable. And then by assigning all of our thoughts to this other thinkingness, we carefully select something which is a vacuum postulate that of unknowingness. So we say, that thing there is doing my thinking for me. So any thinking that is being done around here is being done by that thing there. You certainly keep your attention on it. But the trick is that it doesn't do any thinking at all. So as an individual's dependency on it increases, and as his attention fixates on it more and more, and as he more and more expects something to come out of it, he gets dumber and dumber and dumber. Pretty soon he's not doing any thinking at all. Something has happened to his thinkingness. No, nothing ever happened to his thinkingness, but something happened to the via circuit which transferred the function of thought to something else. Now, there's a lot of people around who are sitting looking at an energy mass expecting it to tell them something. It can't do it. No energy mass can tell a living being anything. But he looks at it, he sees a chair, so he says, well, now that chair is saying it's a chair. But how would you like to get into a condition of life by which every object you saw had some deep future significance for you? We look at the moon, and the phases of the moon determine whether or not we are going to be lucky or unlucky in the next month, and whether or not we will draw our paycheck or not draw our paycheck. And if the phases of the moon are wrong at the instant and our regard toward them is not done the proper way, then we won't draw our paycheck, see? Or we won't be lucky in some fashion. If we feel that if we read a taxi cab number, which is all the same number, that this means that we're going to have a trip to the dentist. And if we get everything cross-referenced so that matter is telling us everything, boy, we'd be the least informed people you ever heard of. That's how to get completely uninformed. See? There just is no better way to get completely uninformed than to have mass tell you everything. But individuals look at the mass in their banks, the pictures on the track, and they expect these pictures to tell them something. All that the pictures tell them is what they themselves tell the pictures to tell them. And if we take that via out, we recall, and we get total recall on the line. Now, these factors, which I have been talking about, are the factors which we face in any preclear. These are the principal phenomena encountered by the auditor. The preclear's belief that he is trying to be right, and the more he does, left to his own devices, the more wrong he will be. We're confronted with that phenomenon. We're confronted with the phenomenon of transference of thought. We're confronted with a phenomenon of persistent activities or thoughts which are misowned. We're confronted by the phenomenon that there are many energy masses in the preclear's vicinity which have stupidity as their central postulate. Now, there's two things we've got to get our preclear to do. Three things, really. On a lower order, we've got to get him accustomed to unlooking on his own consideration and looking on his own consideration. We've got to get him accustomed to doing that. In other words, accustomed to transferring his attention by consideration, not mass. Another thing we've got to get this preclear to do is to make considerations and decisions and unmake them with ease. In other words, we've got to increase his power of choice. And another thing which we've got to get this preclear to do, any way we look at it, is to tolerate not knowingness. And of course, we also could say tolerate confusion, since that's a lower order of not knowingness, but that covers that. We've got to get him to tolerate confusion. In other words, we've got to get him to be able to unfix and fix his attention on his own consideration. We have to get him so that he has a power of choice, which, when confronted with two or more possibilities, you see, and we've got to raise his tolerance of unknowingness or confusion. And if we don't do these things, we leave him there, fixated, chewing on energy, with his brain being processed by him, and he won't get clear. Now, as we confront a pre-clear in this Western culture, we are confronting an enormous number of stable data with regard to thought, which are untrue, which are cultural data. There's no reason we should start to undo these things, but it does leave us in the position of auditors, of finding all the bulk of the well-trained youth who are educated, the better strata, and so forth, a little bit beyond our fingertips at times, because they are unbearably rough cases. They are rough cases because their whole faculty has been transferred thoroughly onto the brain. Psychology is now a compulsory study in most areas of the world. And this, the dictates of this regimen, are antipathetic to their immediate increase. So we find these people tough. Now, when a preclear is tough, the difficulty in his case is discoverable in one or more of the factors which I've gone over in this hour. And it really isn't very much more esoteric than that. It isn't strange. It isn't peculiar. You can look right straight at a preclear and you know what he's doing. Because whatever else could be said about him, and many, many things could be said about him, and many ramifications these things can show up, and there are many particularities which stem out from these things I have mentioned. Nevertheless, these are the central phenomena with which the auditor is concerned, because his not knowing the central postulates will keep him from communicating. It says communication is impossible because there's no terminal there. See, many things branch out from these central phenomena which I've covered. Nevertheless, these are what are wrong with a preclear in auditing. Thank you.